Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell is here with me, and we are speaking with Don Oberdorfer, who is a sleuth of sorts. As a reporter and as a writer of what you call contemporary history, you have availed yourself of a remarkable range of sources. I mean, it's real easy to... I love hearing you talk. Well, when I was talking to Mikhail Gorbachev. But it's a lot more than just the people that you talk with, isn't it? Aren't there all kinds of ways that you access information that I can't get?
Well, you might get it if you're able to go around the world and talk to people and obtain documents and stuff. It was fortunate for me that I spent a lifetime as a correspondent for the Washington Post and 17 years as the Washington Post diplomatic correspondent. So I know leading officials in most countries, most major countries of the world. And that means that when I write them or call them up or something and ask to see them, I have a better chance than somebody.
You're being humble. They say yes.
they often have helped. And then I know people who, just help. Not big people, but ordinary people who've been in some particular place when things are happening. In the case of this book, one of the things that was a real breakthrough for me was a professor in Berlin, in East Germany. He works for a university there in Berlin, who was able to go into the archives of the former East German Communist government, the East German Communist Party, and dig out the memoranda of conversations and other diplomatic dispatches sent from North Korea when the then head of East Germany, Erich Honecker, had a lengthy conversation with Kim Il-sung, the North Korean leader. And Kim Il-sung was a great figure, very important figure. But outside of these materials, we really have no way to know what he was saying privately. We have his public speeches, which, of course, are quite different from what his statements were to the leader of a fellow communist government in Eastern Germany. Well, this is an example of the kinds of things which somehow, if you're digging around enough in this mm-hmm. area,
That's really peeking inside of his mind in a system that was remarkably closed.
Absolutely.
Why were you in Austria looking at things?
But let me also say, this is North Korea, and probably of all the countries in the world, not only was it difficult for journalists, the CIA couldn't get to it, the NSA couldn't, the DIA could not get to it.
I mean, because it was all in this guy's head, yes?
Nobody knew anything. I mean, we were absolutely ignorant and continue to be not terribly knowledgeable.
Bob Gates, who was the CIA director for several years, called it a black hole mm-hmm. and the greatest intelligence challenge on the face of the earth because it is such a closed society.
And is that not also part of the reflection of the great leader, that so much of the authority was centralized and so much of the, gosh, can I say dogma, that the thinking and the acting and everything was so centered on the great leader?
Yes, and in order to protect their ability or his ability to make decisions and not to have them imposed upon him from the outside, even his allies, what they did was to make everything much more secret to keep people out of his decision-making processes. To answer your question, what I was doing in Austria
is that
Vienna, Austria, is the headquarters of the United Nations Nuclear Inspection Group, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And I went and interviewed the inspectors who actually had been to North Korea, mm-hmm. talked to them about their experiences and what they'd done. And that's why I went to Vienna.
I find that fascinating that you would go to so many other parts of the world to find out about North Korea.
Well, I also went to North Korea, but being there, I was there twice, each time for a week. It's a closed society. You're given a guided tour, in effect. Though I met some of the top officials of their government, I got the programmed answer. And there was no ability of mine to reach inside people's minds and say, what are you really thinking? And in fact, I would be very reluctant to ask an ordinary citizen of North Korea any question in which was could possibly have a controversial answer, because that person could find himself in a concentration camp inside 24 hours, and I don't want to take
That's still true. You're not talking about history. You're talking about right now, aren't you?
That is absolutely true, and I don't want to take the responsibility for damaging someone's life in that way.
What you describe, the process sounds like a jigsaw puzzle that operates over time and space. You know, it's not just this nice flat thing, and, oh, by the way, you don't have a picture to go by to figure out how to put the pieces together.
Well,
this is challenging, isn't it?
Yes, it was. I spent 2 years interviewing people and getting documents and getting ways of trying to get a look into not just North Korea, but North Korea and South Korea and U.S. and Chinese and Japanese policy making and Russian. And then I spent 2 years trying to put the pieces together and figure out how to tell this in a way that makes sense to people. And first, it has to make sense to me. Mm-hmm. If I can't figure out what it means, how in the world am I going to explain it to somebody else?
I would think that there's a process that is, you know, you just sort of dig stuff up, and then you see maybe a door opening, and you follow a lead, and some of those are probably rabbit trails, and some of them are probably
blind. Sounds a little like Alice in Wonderland.
There is that. Well, there is that quality. But, you know, they're blind leads, they're dead ends.
I had 450 interviews. If I had known before I had the interviews how they were going to come out, I could have probably had 75 interviews. Because I'd guess maybe 75 or 100 of those were valuable, and the other 350 were, I won't say they were worthless. No, they weren't worthless, but they were not very valuable.
Not major contributors, to
no,
understand.
But you don't know.
Well, and even probably going back now, if you looked at it based on the information you had, you know, you still could not, I mean, knowing what you know now, with the exception of the actual absolute content, you still probably couldn't select that 75 as opposed to the other 300 plus.
That's one of the things about journalism. You never know when you go to see somebody what he has to say or she has to say. And good journalists tend to listen a lot.
How did you pick this for your life's work? What led you into this game of chess?
You mean journalism, you
mm-hmm.
mean? Well, I don't know the answer to that. I grew up in Atlanta, and a friend of mine, who was an intimate friend of mine for my whole life, said that one day I came off the playground when we were in the second grade together and said, when I want to grow up, I want to be a newspaper reporter.
Hmm.
And I started writing a little neighborhood paper when I was 9 years old. I was the editor of my high school newspaper. I was the editor of my college newspaper. I determined very early on I wanted to be a journalist. I was very lucky in that. Most people don't know mm-hmm. until a much later time what they want to do. Or if they do, they pick something that's impossible to be fulfilled, like, you know, winning the 4-minute mile or something like that. I just decided I wanted to do it. I went and did it, and I loved it. And it just, for some reason, I don't know, appealed to me.
I want to go back. You said one of the important things about being a journalist is the ability to listen.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously important. It should be obvious. But don't you have to have some fairly substantive predicates, some understanding, some knowledge, some experience in order to tie that listening together?
Certainly. And one of the people who gave me some very fine advice was Ralph McGill, the late editor of the Atlanta Constitution, who told me, I knew him, I was a copy boy on the Atlanta Constitution in my earliest days, and he said to me, don't bother going to journalism school. Go to some good school and learn as much as you can about history, economics, political science, art, etc.
The world.
The world.
The real world.
I took his advice.
Would you say that's still the case? I mean, I say that because, you know, part of the reason we do this program is a sense that, you know, that people do not have a good sense of what's going on in the world around them. And part of that, I think, is that there are a lot of people writing stories that are graduates of journalism schools without having the predicates and the understandings of the kind of contextual history, economics you pick. That make it possible for them to fully understand what's going on and to understand it in a way that is relevant to me.
I don't want to knock journalism school, and there are probably some good journalism, and there are undoubtedly some good journalism schools. But I think what Mr. McGill said was perfectly true. What's much more important than technique, anybody who has half a brain can learn the technique, is the substance. So you first have to get an understanding and an ability to deal with the substance. Then the technique will come after.
Substance. What do you think of as the substance? I mean, go in, take Korea. Where is the substance in there?
Well, the substance is the history of Korea, the economy of Korea, the ways in which these two parts have related to one another. It's all of the things that are the basic foundation stones of the kind of events that pop out of it. And the reason, really, that I wrote the book that I wrote was that Americans see these headlines popping up from Korea, you know, almost every year, bang, 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 it's in the headlines and then it's gone, and they don't have any sense of where this came from, what is the context, how did this happen, what happened before. It says in the National Archives in Washington, that big thing written on a stone outside the archives, what is past is prologue. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important.
Well, and events typically don't just happen. These are not random nuclear events. They generally spring from, I mean, there is causality.
We're talking with Don Oberdorfer, and we're going to do a little more of that when we come back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Please stay with us.